I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. An estimated 60 Palestinians were killed by Israeli troops on Monday as thousands protested along the Gaza-Israel border, lobbing rocks, Molotov cocktails, and flying gasoline-soaked kites over the fence. Many more were injured. This was part of a six-week campaign, the Great March of Return, organized by Hamas and other groups, demanding the right of Palestinians to return to the land that they were forced to leave when Israel was founded in 1948. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas called the Israeli response a massacre. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu blamed Hamas and said the soldiers acted in self-defense. Also on Monday, the U.S. moved its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, making good on Donald Trump's campaign promise. We asked Stephen Farrell to join us. He is Reuters bureau chief for Israel and Palestine. He's in Jerusalem. Stephen Farrell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be with you.
So what's happening along the border today?
Quiet. It's the first day of Ramadan, so I think to nobody's great surprise, in a Muslim holy month of fasting and in many cases abjuring from water, the likelihood of a lot of people turning out in a very hot, dry, exposed place for protests is low. I think everyone expects things to quieten down from now on through until when the protests are due to end in early June.
I mentioned an estimated 60 Palestinians killed and thousands injured. Do we have those numbers?
Going back over, it's been a six-week protest that began on March the 30th. Yes, certainly, it was the deadliest day on May the 14th, just over half all the people killed in the six-week protest were on that one day. The total for the protests is up at just over 100, about 107, I believe. So it's been, it began with very bloody scenes on March 30th. It peaked over the day of the embassy, and now we're not entirely sure what's going to happen. Everybody seems to be taking stock, but as I say, the plan is apparently for it to go on until early June, which is when both sides here mark the anniversary of the 1967 Six-Day War, and it'll probably end then.
The medical system in Gaza, how is it dealing with this level of casualties, whether it's Monday or the weeks that preceded that?
Badly. There's electricity problems in Gaza. Everything is linked together. Nothing happens in isolation in Gaza. It's sort of the ankle bones connected to the shin bone. There is lack of electricity, which factors into the hospitals. There's a lack of diesel for generators, which one side's blame on Hamas. Hamas blame on both Israel and their rival Palestinian groups who are trying to isolate Hamas. Everything is circular. Everything is connected here. The politics leaks into the military, leaks into the society, leaks into family life. It's all one giant circle.
Well, we read, you mentioned this, but we read about the level of unemployment, the fact that there are scarcities when it comes to things like water. You mentioned electricity. How do people in Gaza, how do they cope with this?
Gaza is in economically probably in worse shape than it's ever been. I think I've spoken to many Palestinians about this. Been into Gaza a couple of times in the last 6 weeks or so. The feeling is that the economy is cratering. Now there are long-standing reasons for that and immediate recent reasons for it. But effectively, I think you would have to say that whatever the political causes of it, what we're seeing is poor people have been poor for a long time in Gaza. 2/3 of Gaza's 2 million people are refugees, but that is leaking up the wealth chain. Businessmen are going out of business. They're defaulting. They're causing other businessmen to default. We've seen slicing away of support structures in Gaza. The reasons for that are, as I say, political, right, military, and so on and so forth. But it's not good. It's bad.
I mean, is there an essential blockade? Is probably too strong a word, but why, for instance, shortages of things like food?
Well, in essence, I think what it comes down to is that Gaza is under a deliberate policy of isolation from its immediate neighbors. And they would say for a very good reason. Since 2007, Gaza has been run, controlled by, you know, an Islamist militant group, Hamas, that the Israel, America, and the Western world regard as terrorists. It's a designated terrorist organization. They said at the beginning, we're not going to do business with it. And they said right from the start that things that get sent into Gaza, many of them get, you send cement in, you allow certain things to go in, you end up seeing them being built, being used to build tunnels, which are used to attack Israel and so on and so forth. So there are restrictions on what goes into Gaza, and there are restrictions on people coming out of Gaza. Economically, realistically, It's the restrictions on people coming out to work. There's no amount of domestic industry in a place like Gaza could support 2 million people. It's tiny. Traditionally, Gaza has been, in past decades, it was people working in the Gulf countries sending back wages home. It was people working in Israel. It was people working in Egypt. As those opportunities for work declined, for again many reasons, political, going back many years, regional as well as local, then those salaries stopped going back to Gaza. The economy went down. There's now the American, the Trump administration has been very, has said it's going to cut funding to the United Nations Refugee Agency in Gaza. So you can see the pillars of Gaza's economy one by one eroding, not just over the last 5 years, over decades. It's been a long, slow process.
Well, what do you imagine then the future of Gaza will be?
Well, I think what is going on at the moment, and it's neither side makes any bones about it. Hamas is running Gaza. It controls the guns. It controls everything in Gaza. And that is anathema both to Israel and to a more secular, more moderate Palestinian administration in the West Bank, which is also seeking to isolate Hamas. So, and Egypt to the southern flank of Gaza are seeking to isolate Hamas. So you're seeing more and more desperation. Again, for what others say are perfectly good reasons, security reasons, political reasons. But the upshot is there's poverty in Gaza. Ordinary people are suffering, and you know they don't know which way to turn. They're kind of trapped, caught in between all these political military players.
Let me go back to this campaign that started in March, the Great March of Return. I said in my introduction, it is Palestinians essentially wanting to return to the land that they were forced to leave when Israel was founded since 1948, so 70 years ago. Was this Hamas's idea, or was this more a grassroots uprising in a way?
I think, yes, we're at the 70-year mark. I mean, a 70-year anniversary that obviously the Israelis celebrate with joy and delight and with pride, the independence of their country, 7 decades of a country they're proud of. The reverse side of the coin is, of course, for Palestinians, 1948 was a defeat. Many of them fled or were driven into exile and are now refugees. What this protest sought to do was to use the anniversary to draw attention to what the Palestinians demand, which is a right of return to lands, to homes, to villages, which their fathers, forefathers used to live in, but now they can't return to because they're in Israel. So that was the purpose of it. Now, there was a committee of non-Hamas people who set it up. There was a grassroots element to it. There's no question about that. At some point, Hamas got involved as well. What we have seen in recent weeks was one thing going on in tents a few hundred meters back from the border, you know, speeches, community activities, communal activities, rhetoric and so forth. And down at the fence, we've seen altogether different scenes. We've seen mostly young men, you know, throwing stones, slingshots, et cetera, at the fence, at the border. And I think, you know, talking to my Gaza colleague, I mean, it's produced a sort of a dual scene, if you like. So people about hundreds of yards back, and protesters taking much more sort of aggressive action, if you like, right down by the fence, right in front of Israeli soldiers, who have responded with lethal force.
Well, there was another duel scene, and this is obviously what was happening along that border, and the fact that the U.S. was opening its embassy in Jerusalem at that same time. Do those two pictures represent what's going on in that region of the world today?
I mean, it was an extraordinary day. The split screen day, if you like. As everybody saw, you have the opening of an embassy. Israelis, Americans, Ivanka Trump, Jared Kushner, everybody gathered, and at the same time, going on over the border. I mean, does that reflect what's going on in the world? I mean, in a sense, going back to what I said earlier on, it's a 70-year anniversary, and one side won that battle, if you like, and the other side feels it lost. So yes, the same day, the same two or three days are seen as in polar opposite ways here. And what we saw at the protests and what we saw at the embassy reflect that.
Stephen, I can't do justice to a profile you did of a 96-year-old who lives in Jerusalem, Mohammed Mahmoud Jadala. And he remembers the founding of Israel in 1948. Tell us about him.
Yeah, he's a very interesting man. He was born in 1921. He was born in a village which is directly south of the old city of Jerusalem, and he was. We just went along to talk to him. It was on his village is the village that claims the land where the embassy went, or part of the land where the embassy was originally, their land farmed by them and so on. And we went to talk to him, and it's just an extraordinary moment when you normally you turn up and you talk to people and they say, oh, my grandfather told me, or my father told me, and you suddenly realize that this man is, he was there. He remembers every single moment of the of not only the 70 years, but before that, the King David Hotel bombing. He was a waiter in the hotel back in 46. He's quite open about the fact that in 1948, he was in uniform with a gun fighting against Jewish forces, which later became Israeli forces. And then he sat and watched every milestone since then. In the 1967 war, the peace treaties. What I find most interesting about him, apart from the fact that he was present at so many moments, was that I asked him, I said, at any point in your nearly a century long life, have you felt that peace was going to come? He said, no, I never felt at any moment that any of these initiatives had any chance, which is a very sad thing to hear from an old man.
But obviously an old man who has lived through so much of this. Stephen Farrell, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times, getting our conversation started.
You're welcome.
And that's Stephen Farrell. He is Reuters Bureau Chief for Israel and the Palestinian Territories, joining us from Jerusalem. We're going to take a very short break and then talk more about what has happened this week in that region of the world, including the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, the move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've been talking about what happened on Monday in Israel and Gaza. While thousands of Palestinians protested along the border, 60 were killed and many more wounded by Israeli forces, the U.S. opened its new embassy in Jerusalem, marking the 70th anniversary of the founding of that country and making good on Donald Trump's campaign promise. Israel's been criticized for its response to the protests using live ammunition. Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, defended Israel and later walked out when a Palestinian representative to the U.N. spoke.
Who among us would accept this type of activity on your border? No one would. No country in this chamber would act with more restraint than Israel has. In fact, the records of several countries here today suggest they would be much less restrained. Those who suggest that the Gaza violence has anything to do with the location of the American embassy are sorely mistaken. Rather, the violence comes from those who reject the existence of the State of Israel in any location. Such a motivation the destruction of a United Nations member state is so illegitimate as to not be worth our time in the Security Council, other than the time it takes to denounce it.
We asked Michael Koplow to join us, policy director of the Israel Policy Forum. He's a regular contributor to Foreign Affairs and Foreign Policy magazine, and he joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Michael Koplow, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
Let me ask you about that split screen. I put that to our previous guest, to Stephen Farrell, about what happened on Monday. On the one hand, you know, we see the demonstrations, the tear gas, the sort of violence along the Gaza-Israel border. And on the other hand, this, you know, beautiful ceremony opening this new embassy in Jerusalem.
It was definitely a striking scene. Anyone who watched the embassy ceremony in Jerusalem could see right away how important this was to Israelis and to Israeli leadership. And it's for good reason. Jerusalem is Israel's capital. It has been since the founding of the state. The institutions of the Israeli government were located in West Jerusalem back in 1948, including the Knesset and the High Court. They aren't on disputed land, and so Israelis have for a long time felt that they are subjected to an unfair double standard where they are the only country in the world that does not have the right to choose its own capital. And by the United States moving its embassy to Jerusalem, it really gives Israelis a sense of legitimacy and a sense of normalcy that they have really craved for 70 years. On the other hand, you, of course, had the demonstrations on the Gaza border and 62 people being killed on Monday and thousands injured. And that illustrates something to Israelis as well, which is that no matter how good things look in some parts of the world and their standing in the international community, they still have this festering Palestinian issue that is not going away and does not look like it's going to go away anytime soon. And the Israeli government itself has in many ways been woefully inadequate in dealing with it.
Well, Nikki Haley saying, who amongst us, you know, and question whether other countries would do the same. Theresa May was deeply troubled by the use of live fire, the scale of the violence. The French President Emmanuel Macron condemned the violence of the Israeli armed forces against the protesters. I do want to talk more about the embassy, but just this response from Israel. There was actually an editorial on the New York Times today saying that Israel has to come up with a better response to what they see as threats along this border with Gaza.
I think it's significantly more complicated than either Nikki Haley or European leaders want to see it. On the one hand, I think Nikki Haley is right. I can't think of many countries or any countries in the world that would stand by when you have 40,000 demonstrators, the majority of whom are there because they want to cross your border and return to their homes before Israel was established, but a significant minority of whom are armed and violent and declare quite openly that they want to get into Israel to kill and injure Israelis. So, you know, I can't think of any country that would simply sit back and let that happen.
Right.
And certainly, you know, the blame for much of this has to be placed on Hamas, which is a terrorist group, according to the United States and the European Union, and which has used all sorts of tactics to get people to the fence and in some ways sort of benefits from having casualties. On the other hand, Israeli tactics definitely can be questioned. I think that we saw tear gas, but the Israelis elected not to use rubber bullets and not to use water cannons, and you know, we can debate why that is. I think that there's a question as to whether rubber bullets are effective at that long of a range. You know, we can debate whether it would be better for the Israelis to wait for Palestinians to actually get through the fence before using live fire. But you know, I think that there is blame to be had on both sides. And taking a Manichaean view that Israel is blameless or that Israel is entirely at fault is certainly not consistent with the facts.
So this cycle of violence and recrimination will just go on. It's sort of hard to see how that is either stopped or somehow ameliorated.
So I think when it comes to Gaza, the focus is really better placed on the long-term strategy and the long-term solution rather than the short-term tactics used to repel the demonstrations and repel Hamas fighters from crossing the fence. You know, as your previous guest noted, Gaza has been a problem now for over a decade, and there has to be some sort of way to ease the blockade and allow the economy in Gaza to improve and to allow humanitarian aid to come in. And from the Israeli perspective, you know, you have two threats here. One threat is that you ease the blockade and Hamas is able to build more rockets and build more tunnels and do damage to Israelis. The other threat is that you keep everything as it is and Gaza explodes. According to the UN, Gaza is only going to be habitable for another 2 years. And, you know, Israel is very good at dealing with that first type of threat. Between Iron Dome, between the subterranean wall that is being built right now to deal with tunnels, between IDF patrols, they're good at dealing with that type of conventional threat. I honestly have no idea how Israel or any country will cope with a situation in Gaza where it's literally uninhabitable and you have diseases like polio and cholera that don't respect borders. And I think that it would be wiser for Israel to think about these two threats and think about which one it is better equipped to deal with.
Let me just reintroduce you. That's Michael Koplo, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. He's policy director of the Israel Policy Forum and, again, a regular contributor to Foreign Affairs and Foreign Policy magazines. And I do want to talk about this embassy and the peace process. Let me just read a couple of comments. Tweet, Israel worked hard to get rid of Arafat and the PLO. Now it's complaining that Hamas is worse. Maybe their strategy is destined to lead to perpetual war. An email from Leslie, as a Native American, I can only side with the Palestinians. Their land was taken by an occupying group. Why does no one see this? I'm just going to let those comments sit there. They're important. But I do want to talk a bit more about the setup of this embassy, the move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. The Clinton administration, the Bush administration, the Obama administration signed waivers not moving the embassy there. Obviously, President Trump decided to do that. Does it put an end to the peace process, knowing that whatever two-state solution is finally arrived at, a Palestinian country would have their capital in Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem?
I don't think it puts an end to the peace process, but I think it makes it almost impossible to conduct any type of viable peace process during the Trump administration. And it isn't because the embassy was moved to Jerusalem, but it is because of the manner in which it was done. I think that, as I said earlier, Jerusalem is Israel's capital. It is appropriate for the American embassy to be there. But Jerusalem is also, of course, the most contested territory in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, both physically and emotionally. And to give the Israelis a win on Jerusalem, and it was a very unambiguous win. Mm-hmm. President Trump on December 6th stated that the United States was recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. He did not say West Jerusalem or delineate it geographically. And so this was a clear win for Israel and a clear loss for the Palestinians. And the unfortunate part is that it did not have to be so zero-sum. Mm. President Trump could have easily recognized West Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, announced that the United States was moving its embassy to Jerusalem, as it did, and make clear that in the future, when there is a two-state solution and there is an independent state of Palestine, at that time, the United States will recognize some part of East Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine and move its embassy there. That would have been a very simple fix that would not have made this such a zero-sum game. But the fact that it was made such a zero-sum game means that the Palestinians now have disengaged from the United States entirely.
What does the United States get out of moving its embassy to Jerusalem?
Israel is obviously an important and stalwart ally of the United States, and so in some ways, it's simply a measure of support to an important ally in the region. In other ways, it really plays into Republican and presidential politics, because the Republican base views Jerusalem and Israel's status in Jerusalem and the United States embassy in Jerusalem as important political issues. It's particularly important to evangelicals, who, of course, form a very important component of the GOP base, and who were distrustful of President Trump, then candidate Trump, when he was running for president. And this was an easy way to signal to them that Trump knows their priorities and keeps them in mind and has their back. In addition, the most important donor to the Republican Party at the moment is Sheldon Adelson, and this was a big issue for him. And it was I think, in a lot of ways, something of a thank you to him as well.
I mean, the United States has been a stalwart ally of Israel since Israel, mostly since Israel's founding, and of course, a benefactor as well. But previous presidents have criticized Israel for settlements or certain other of their policies. Do you think there'll be any daylight between Israel and the United States? And I ask that knowing that the United States has pulled out of the Iran deal, something that Israel does support.
There has been significant daylight between Israel and the United States in this administration on some issues, and no daylight on others. When it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, there has been no daylight, and certainly on Monday, the White House statement responding to what was going on in Gaza was qualitatively different, I think, than statements that were issued by previous administrations, including previous Republican administrations. So on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, the Trump administration really seems to be directly in line with Israel's priorities and Israel's wishes, and there really is no daylight between the two. On an issue like Syria, that has actually caused serious friction behind the scenes between Israel and the United States, where Israel views its greatest security threat at the moment as Iranian entrenchment in Syria, and the last thing Israel wants to see is the U.S. disengaging from Syria in any way. And when President Trump announced that he wanted U.S. troops out of Syria as soon as possible, that caused real worry in Jerusalem and with the Israeli security establishment. And so I think that the no daylight question, it simply depends on what issue you're looking at.
There are, I guess, ongoing talks of a peace process. I mean, must be said, it's something that other administrations have gotten close, but have been really not able to create this two-state solution. Do you have any confidence in Jared Kushner and his, I forget what his first name is, but his last name is Greenblatt, that they can do something that others have not?
The two-state solution is enormously important. It really cannot be understated. It is the key to preserving Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. In many ways, it is the key to preserving a robust and bipartisan U.S.-Israel relationship. And so there's a reason this has been a priority for American administrations, including this one. Now, the Trump administration's approach the first year in office was for Jared Kushner and Jason Greenblatt to go to the region and listen to both sides and talk to as many people as possible. And they got many plaudits for doing that. But whatever plan they've been working on has been kept very under wraps. Mm-hmm. And even if they had the most well-developed, robust, thoughtful plan in the history of American diplomacy, when President Trump announced the American recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and the embassy move on December 6th, and again, doing it in the manner in which he did it, it completely blew up any peace process, because the Palestinians not only disengaged from the peace process, but have been boycotting American officials ever since, and have now said repeatedly that they do not view the U.S. as being able to play the role as central mediator in this conflict. And so even if the Kushner-Greenblatt-David Friedman peace plan is a great one and hits all the right notes, without engagement from the Palestinians on whatever the U.S. has come up with, it's impossible to have any real process.
You mentioned Sheldon Adelson. Does he want a peace process? If he's, obviously he holds great sway with the Trump administration.
Never having met Sheldon Adelson, I certainly cannot speak for him personally or what his views are. But from what I can tell from his public comments, he generally views a peace process as a waste of time because he does not support a two-state solution. He would like to see Israel annex the West Bank and control all of the land between the river and the sea. And certainly he's not the only person either in the United States or in Israel who holds that view. But it is important to note that a majority of Israelis support a two-state solution. The policy of the Israeli government is officially to support two states under the right conditions. And as I said before, it really is the most critical issue to Israel's future going forward, and I think to the U.S.-Israel relationship as well. So whatever Sheldon Adelson's preferences are, I think it's pretty clear that it is in an American interest and certainly an Israeli and Palestinian interest to have a two-state solution.
But if not the U.S., if the U.S. is not going to be spearheading this, is there another country that could or would or maybe even be able to get to some kind of resolution that has eluded the United States?
It's difficult to see this happening without the United States for a couple of reasons. For starters, Israel trusts the United States. It does not trust other parties. I think that the Israelis have very good reasons to feel that way, given Israel's treatment at the United Nations and in other international arenas. Second, any deal that happens between Israel and the Palestinians is going to require a lot of heavy lifting by outside parties financially to secure Israel's borders, to compensate Palestinian refugees, to make sure the peace holds. And the United States is really the only country in the world that has the wherewithal to do all of these things. And, the United States, I think in many ways it's a cliche that the United States is indispensable, but when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and resolving it and thinking about what a final status agreement will look like and enforcing it down the road, the U.S. truly is indispensable. And so I don't think there's a way around that, but, I'm also equally confident that the Palestinians are so upset at the Trump administration and so despondent that they are not going to engage with the Trump administration and the U.S., certainly for the foreseeable future.
Michael, can you stay with us? We have another guest who will be joining us, but she's in a cab.
I'd be delighted to.
I'm a little worried about our connection with her. That's Michael Koplow, a policy director of the Israel Policy Forum. And we'll be talking about what Israel means to evangelicals after this very short break. And we do have a guest in a cab waiting in the wings. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We've been getting an update on what's been happening on the border between Israel and Gaza. Also talking about the impact of moving the U.S. embassy on the peace process. And now we want to focus on the role of evangelical Christians in shaping the Trump administration's Israeli policies. Robert Jeffress, pastor of the First Baptist Church in Dallas, delivered a prayer at the opening of the new U.S. embassy in Jerusalem on Monday.
And now, Father, as we come to dedicate this embassy in the city of Jerusalem, the city that you named as the capital of Israel 3,000 years ago, we want to thank you for the tremendous leadership of our great president, Donald J. Trump. Without President Trump's determination, resolve, courage, we would not be here today. And I believe, Father, I speak for every one of us when we say, we thank you every day that you have given us a president who boldly stands on the right side of history, but more importantly, stands on the right side of you, O God, when it comes to Israel.
Jeffress is one of President Trump's closest evangelical advisors. John Hagee, another evangelical preacher, was also at the opening ceremony and gave the benediction. So what were two preachers who have said hateful things about Jews and other religions doing at the U.S. Embassy? Elizabeth Dias joins us, national correspondent for The New York Times. She covers faith and politics. And yes, she is in a cab in Washington, D.C., I think. Elizabeth, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Michael Koplow is staying with us as well. And again, he's policy director of the Israel Policy Forum. So let me put to both of you, but I'll start with you, Elizabeth. What were these two preachers doing at the U.S. Embassy on Monday?
Well, I think we have to take a step back and look at the longstanding relationship that American evangelicals like Pastor Jeffress and Hagee have both with American officials and with evangelical Christians who support Israel and with the Jewish people in the region. I mean, for many folks here, some of their comments in the past that you cited might seem unusual, but You know, in American evangelical communities that support Israel, they see pastors like Jefferson Hagee as some of their fiercest advocates for this, as do many conservative Jews in Israel. So it's not quite as simple as, you know, as one might think.
Well, no, it clearly isn't simple, but I do feel the need to say some of the things that Jeffress has said, also John Hagee as well. Jeffress has talked about you can't be saved by being a Jew. Mormonism is a heresy from the pit of hell. He has also talked about Catholicism and Satan. Michael Koppel, to you, how do you make sense of people who have said those things in the past being at the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, opening this embassy in the state of Israel?
I find it enormously troubling and disappointing. I don't think that anyone should be surprised that there was a large evangelical presence at the embassy opening, given the importance of Israel and Jerusalem to the evangelical community. But the choice of these two particular pastors really, I think, turns off many people. It certainly turns off many American Jews, and I think that it is really a comment on the way that Israel is being turned into a partisan issue. I would be remiss if I didn't note that there was not one Democrat elected official invited to the embassy opening, which is extraordinary given that this is the American embassy to Israel, not the Republican embassy to Israel. And I think that the presence of these two pastors who play a large role in GOP politics really sends a message that this was intended to be a celebration for some people, but not for others.
Well, and John Hagee, I can't play his clip because it's rather convoluted, but he has said in the past that Israel was created for the Jews to return, and those that didn't were killed by the Nazis, killed in the Holocaust, essentially that this was God's plan. And I'm paraphrasing there, so forgive me for that. But if I can go back to you, Elizabeth, so for evangelicals, what then does Israel mean? What does that land mean to them?
The land? Well, American evangelical conservative ones who are pretty pro-Israel see the land as, you know, what's happening with the state of Israel is fulfilling God's promise to restore the land, you know, to the Jewish people. I hear evangelicals talk about how Jerusalem, they see that as the capital of the land for 3,000 years, going back to biblical times. So it's a lot of spiritual terms that, you know, as you were rightly pointing out, have become highly partisan, highly politicized now. But for, you know, the Trump administration, who has built such ties with American evangelicals, really, I mean, that's American evangelicals put Trump in the White House in such high record numbers. So for the White House, this is fulfilling a central campaign promise to name Jerusalem the capital, put the U.S. embassy there, and we have to say, at a very important political time ahead of the midterms in the fall, when there's enormous opposition to the president and his agenda and the Republican Party coming from the left. And so it's really critical to turn out that evangelical base around the country. And so that's another reason we're seeing such big display right now about what the president has done for Israel and trying to rally evangelicals around that.
Well, and I can understand why evangelicals and the president might favor this, but I'm thinking about Jews and Israelis. And let me quote from Hagee again, and I'll toss this to you, Michael Koppelow. Hagee said, "I've been asked 101 times plus, why do you think Donald Trump win? And I have an immediate answer, because he was the only one that was blessing Israel." How do you see evangelicals' relationship or view of Israel?
I think that Israel, as Elizabeth noted, is enormously important to evangelicals. And I think that particularly for this president, who was distrusted by evangelicals when he was campaigning for a whole variety of reasons, you know, he certainly did not look like a social conservative or a religious conservative or even a particularly religious person. I think that checking the evangelical boxes on Israel is a way to signal to evangelicals that the president can be trusted, that he understands their priorities, and that he will fulfill his campaign promises to them. And, you know, this was a campaign promise that was important to them and that he brought up repeatedly. And I don't think anyone should be surprised that this is one that he sort of rushed to fulfill.
But, and I'll go back to you, Michael, but how do you think people who attended that ceremony on Monday at the U.S. Embassy, did they know what these two men had said in the past about Jews and Judaism?
Well, Pastor Hagee, I think everyone was familiar with him. You know, he is also the founder of Christians United for Israel, which is easily the largest pro-Israel lobbying group in the United States. It has tens of thousands of members and enormous influence. And so I think people certainly are familiar with Pastor Hagee well before this past Monday. Again, the crowd there was intentionally, at least on the American side, a Republican right-leaning crowd. And on the Israeli side, while you certainly had a wide array of Israeli political figures from across the spectrum, the leaders of nearly every political party came. Israelis, in a lot of ways, they very much appreciate the evangelical support. Mm-hmm. They know that it is contributing to a strong Israel relationship. Israelis on the right know that it is contributing to support for right-wing Israeli policies. And so a lot of Israelis, when they hear the types of things that Hagee has said in the past, they kind of shrug their shoulders and laugh because they certainly don't believe that any of this will come to pass. And they simply appreciate the unflinching, unqualified support.
Elizabeth, I wonder how many evangelicals have this view of Israel and the return of Jesus, the beginning of the rapture, the end of times. How does that figure into our conversation?
It's very widespread in the United States and also among evangelicals around the world. I mean, this isn't just something isolated to here. This is a very common theological belief. And so the idea that, I can think of so many different sources and people I've interviewed over the years who have said or who would say similar things, right? Like that, you have to believe in Jesus in order to go to heaven. Mm-hmm. And so they see that not as that's something that is in opposition to their support in their minds for the Jewish people, but actually as something that they've been able to work out over the years. I mean, part of the challenge is that, for 2,000 years, Christianity has sort of tried to supersede Israel and Judaism by saying, Jesus, who is Jewish, you have to believe in him to be saved. And so this is something that each generation of Christians needs to work out. Like, how do they relate to the Jewish people, and at what point, like, can they stay friends and really work together on some of these policy ideas, but also maintain difference theologically about some things?
What happens to Jews at the end of times?
For many evangelicals, I think that they are really conflicted about that. There's not one set answer. Most often I hear about it from people who feel pretty conflicted about it. But in the end, like Pastor Jeffress, they say you have to believe in Jesus to be saved. Hmm. And then there are some who say that God has a special carve out for the Jewish people. These are the kinds of questions that churches across the country and around the world, I think, wrestle with. So when it breaks into public view like this, it really hits home for a lot of people and raises the kinds of questions that we're talking about.
Sure. I mean, Michael, this is, maybe it's not complicated. I don't know. Do you wrestle with this?
Well, my view as an American Jew is that evangelicals are welcome to whatever views that they want to have, the same way that I'm welcome to whatever views that I want to have. And I would note that there, as Elizabeth says, there definitely seems to be, from what I can tell, a split between evangelical supporters of Israel, where some of them certainly believe in the theological implications of the rapture and the second coming and believe that Israel must be supported so that Israel can eventually be destroyed. But there also are a significant portion of evangelicals who believe that since the Bible says those who bless the Jews will be blessed themselves, that it is important to support Israel and Jews because it is a biblical commandment. And, you know, to my mind, the second group, it's wonderful to have their support. The first group, as I noted, many Israeli leaders take the view that it's great, they're supporting us, it doesn't matter what they think. My own personal views are that Jews in Israel don't necessarily need to have friends like that.
Oh, interesting. Let me read a comment from Michael from Bucks County who says, the religious interest of evangelicals in a sovereign Israel is part of their messianic prophecy that they need the Jews to come to Israel for the second coming of their Messiah, religious agenda that doesn't have anything to do with Judaism. Elizabeth, you cover faith and politics. Can you speak to Michael's comment there?
Which comment?
Well, I guess that this religious agenda doesn't have anything to do with Judaism. I mean, this the evangelicals, the idea that they need Jews in order for the second coming of the Messiah, and that it really has nothing to do with religion per se.
I think there isn't a blanket answer for that. Some American evangelicals definitely see the prophecy is all sort of tied up in that. But I think others are really have pushed back against this sort of longstanding suspicion that the only reason American evangelicals are so interested in Israel and its political fate is that they secretly want to convert everybody, which, you know, has been a reality in some cases and a suspicion in other cases for decades. I just think that there's just a real range of views in that area.
We're almost out of time here. Let me just read a couple of comments. One from Avi from Balakim. What a careful check of the actions of governments of Israel since Rabin's assassination reveals that Israel's consistent long-term strategy is to try to gradually move most of Palestinians to neighboring Arab states. Please comment. Can you, Michael, we're almost out of time here, but do you have a comment for Avi?
I would say there is zero support for that proposition. Since 1993, Israel has not tried to move Palestinians out of their territory to other Arab states at all. I think one can question whether the Israeli government ever intends to leave the West Bank and what their views are on the ultimate resolution of the Palestinian issue. But the notion that Israel has been trying to transfer Palestinians out of the areas in which they live, I don't know where anyone would see evidence for that.
Well, we have to end on that note. Michael Koplov, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times, Policy Director of the Israel Policy Forum. He joined us from the NPR studios in New York. He's a regular contributor to Foreign Affairs and Foreign Policy magazine. Michael, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also joining us from a cab in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Diaz, national correspondent for The New York Times. She covers faith and politics. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Also, to download a podcast of Radio Times, go to iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.